From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The nation is in the throes of a cancer epidemic. Much cancer is avoidable, but through both personal action, for whereby citizens protect themselves, and also political action to reverse the reckless irresponsibility of the National Cancer Institute and the American Cancer Society, who we fund to discharge responsibilities in the cancer area and who have abysmally failed.
Today, the politics of cancer. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Today, a special on cancer. But first, this news from Sierra Leone. Days after disappearing, the rebel leader whose followers burned, looted, maimed, and killed across Sierra Leone was captured yesterday by pro-government forces who shot him in the leg, stripped him naked, and turned him over to government officials. The seizure of Fodai Sanko, whose Revolutionary United Front has terrorized civilians, prompted joyous celebrations in the streets of Freetown, where thousands have died during 8 years of civil war. Questions remain whether Sanko's capture would speed an end to Sierra Leone's reignited civil war or spur his Revolutionary United Front followers to even more violence. Human Rights Watch yesterday urged a fair trial for Sanko, even by an international tribunal, saying he shouldn't be subjected to mob rule despite extensive evidence of involvement in crimes against humanity. Meanwhile, despite the uncertainty surrounding the future of Sierra Leone's peace process, Britain has proposed expanding the size of the besieged UN peacekeeping force to 13,000 to accommodate new troops. We're joined on the phone right now by Abdul Rahman Laman of the Coalition for Democracy in Sierra Leone. He's currently a graduate student in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Abdul Rahman Laman.
Thank you for having me, Amy.
What is your response to the latest news of Fodai Sanko captured, taken through the streets naked and shot?
Well, I think, first of all, it's a welcome news to hear that Fodai Sanko has finally been located and captured. Now, the fact that he was paraded around the streets naked, is something I personally would say he deserved. I think the government moved very fast, though, to try to prevent any mob action from taking place, and I think that is welcome, too. Now, as you said in your setup piece, his capture raises more questions than answers, obviously. And that is why I think there has to be a very serious discussion now, especially in the international community, on what happens to Fodai Sanko next. Now, I can tell you what the Sierra Leoneans would like to see not happen in this circumstance. As you know, the RAF is still holding over 200 UN peacekeepers, and we would insist that the capture of Fodai Sanko should not be used as a bargaining chip to free those hostages. The RAF must be told in uncertain terms by the international community that it must release the UN hostages it is holding unconditionally and unharmed. The arrest of Fodai Sanko cannot be linked to the release of those hostages. That is something that has to be very, very clear. But beyond that, I think now there is a responsibility on the part of the international community, specifically the United Nations, to institute proceedings to have Fodai Sanko tried as an international war criminal.
Abdul Rahman Laman, what about the British paratroopers in Sierra Leone who killed three members, I think, of the RUF and also wounded a civilian? Is this of concern to you?
Well, we are obviously concerned about any violence in our country, certainly. But again, it's our information that the British forces were attacked by the rebels, who ostensibly were reacting to the arrest of Fodai Sanko. We are going to have this kind of situations, but I think the firmer we take a stance as a community of nations around the world and send a clear message to the RAF that their thuggery will not be tolerated, the better, we would be in a way of putting Sierra Leone back to the road to peace. So, sure, it's a concern, but again, it has to be looked at from the standpoint of an organization which has clearly been given an opportunity way beyond what it deserves, but still continues to create problems. And I think now is the time to stand tough and say to the RUF that they will no longer get away with what they've been doing for the last 10 years.
I want to thank you very much for being with us, Abdulrahman Laman, student in Washington, D.C., grad student of the Coalition for Democracy in Sierra Leone. And we will certainly continue to follow that story. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. According to a report leaked to the Washington Post, the U.S. government is poised to declare firmly that dioxin, a toxin found throughout the food supply and in the bodies of most people in the world, causes cancer in people. Made notorious when it was fingered as the toxic component in Agent Orange, used to clear forests in the Vietnam War, dioxin caused the evacuation of the town of Times Beach, Missouri in 1983 and the Love Canal site in Niagara Falls, New York in 1978. The leaked report upgrades dioxin to the status of a human carcinogen. Well, today on Democracy Now!, we're going to take a look at the politics of cancer, from the pharmaceutical companies to the nonprofits that claim to be fighting the disease. We're going to look at the cancer establishments, specifically the National Cancer Institute and the American Cancer Society. We're joined right now by Dr. Sam Epstein. He returns to our airwaves to continue our discussion. Dr. Epstein, when you were here before, we got so many calls. When you came back to New York, we felt it was critical to have you back on the air. Dr. Sam Epstein is a professor of occupational and environmental medicine at the School of Public Health, University of Illinois Medical Center at Chicago, an internationally recognized authority on the toxic and carcinogenic effects of environmental pollutants in air, water, and the workplace, and also an expert on the ingredients and contaminants in consumer products, food, cosmetics, and household products. I want to start off with interesting news that I have really only heard about from you, brought to my attention by you. The idea of a top-secret world science court? What is this all about? Who has proposed it, and what is your concern?
Well, at the recent Economic Summit Conference in Davos, which is an annual conference of heads of nations and other prominent political figures, Bruce Alberts, the president of the National Academy of Sciences, proposed to other national academies of governments all over the world that they should set up an international advisory council or commission to provide scientific guidance to governments on a wide range of policies ranging from biodiversity to health and safety. Well, everybody would agree that governments worldwide need scientific information, but is the NAS model, is the National Academy of Science model, the right way to go? And the answer is certainly not. The National Academy of Sciences and its National Research Council is funded at the present moment by 85% of its funding comes from federal aid from government and 15% from non-federal sources. But in spite of the strong tie-in with the government, the National Academy of Sciences remains a closed shop. It defies the Federal Advisory Committee Act, which requires that meetings should be open, there should be balanced representation, there should be open declaration of conflicts of interest. It's a closed shop, and it's heavily dominated and influenced by industry interests. For instance, in 1996, the National Academy of Sciences National Research Council produced a report trivializing the significance of carcinogenic pesticides in foods. This committee was heavily represented with industry experts, so-called experts, and I wrote to Bruce Alberts at the time warning him about this, and he replied, it's true, yes, these people are industry consultants, but they've also consulted to government agencies, therefore they're all right. Then more recently still, at the last year, the National Research Council had created a committee to look into the question of genetically engineered products, and the committee as initially constituted was top-heavy with industry representatives. And then 3 or 4 months during the deliberations, the executive director, Dr. Michael Phillips, suddenly resigned, and in fact he had been negotiating with the Technology Bioindustry Association to take the new job. So
the Biotechnology Industry Organization is what a
is an umbrella
PR
group
arm lobbying arm.
Well,
for
it's an umbrella. It's a trade group for the biotechnology industries. So here we're dealing with an attempt by Bruce Alberts to create a secret world science court in which they have their own rules, non-transparent, closed to the public, no representation of scientific advisors to non-governmental organizations, and especially as now they're hunting around, the National Academy of Sciences is hunting around for non-federal sources of funding, which means industry. So Bruce Alberts has no idea what democracy is. He might as well be a medievalist somehow saying that we will decide what's good for the nation. And this is an outrage in the year 2000 for Bruce Alberts to try to set up a secret world science court which operates secretly, makes recommendations under these non-transparent, non-democratic procedures. And very recently we've been told that that Bruce Alberts has approached Kofi Annan, and Kofi Annan in principle,
UN Secretary General.
So I urge listeners to write in or to call the channel and object and very strongly to the Bruce Alberts' world secret cabal of scientists, presumably largely representing industry and special interests, and warn Kofi Annan this is one of the most dangerous recent developments, taking decision making out of the hands of independent experts and putting them in the hands of a group that has a track record of overwhelming conflicts of interest and a complete lack of understanding and recognition of fundamental principles of democracy.
Dr. Sam Epstein with us talking about this latest information of the president of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, Bruce Alberts, and an unheralded group of a dozen other presidents of national science academies quietly gathering behind the scenes at the World Economic Forum in Davos, proposing the creation of an International Academy Council, an IAC, as a global science advisory board. Well, I wanted to look at a number of issues that are of grave concern to people in this country and around the world. And it really has to do with the daily products we use, the foods that we eat. Let's talk about saccharin.
Well, saccharin, as early as the mid-70s, saccharin had been clearly shown to be carcinogenic, to induce cancer in mice and in rats, not only in bladder, but also in a wide range of organs besides the bladder. Now, the reason why I mentioned bladder, I'll come to in a moment. In addition to that, a very substantial epidemiological study has shown that people that regularly use sweeteners have major increases in the risks of bladder cancer. Now, the only having with that as a background, let me mention that the only requirement until very recently for listing any carcinogen in foods was for saccharin in diet foods, and particularly the sweet and low and other diet foods which contain saccharin. And there was a warning added to that, that this may cause cancer. This causes cancer in animals, so beware. Now, the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences and the National Toxicology Program, under the direction of Dr. Ken Olden, has recently recommended and decided that saccharin should no longer be listed as a carcinogen, so FDA will be withdrawing this warning. Now, I should mention that the Board of Scientific Counselors, non-governmental advisors to the National Toxicology Program, voted against Olden's proposal to delist saccharin, and in spite of that, he proceeded to say it wasn't carcinogenic on the grounds that there's evidence that the mechanism for bladder formation is in rats is nonspecific, ignoring the fact that even at low doses, saccharin induces cancers in a wide range of other organs in rodents, and ignoring a solid epidemiological study clearly incriminating saccharin in relation to bladder cancer in humans. And in this, basically what has happened is Ken Olden, together with friendly contacts at the Food and Drug Administration, including Dr. Bernard Schwetz, who used to work for Dow Chemical Company, who never saw a carcinogen that he didn't like, working together with them, has ignored the scientific evidence, and under pressure and under influence from the Calorie Control Council, has given in. And I charge Dr. Olden, Ken Olden, with reckless irresponsibility, and urge that he be brought before appropriate congressional committees to explain and account for his conduct, which I believe is tantamount to public health crime.
Can you explain the difference between saccharin, aspartame, NutraSweet? Which one is banned? Isn't it saccharin in this country?
Well, we're talking now specifically about saccharin. And let me point out that there's two problems in this. The majority of uses of saccharin are in sweet and low, which people have a package and adults use it. However, there is another very important source of exposure, and sweet and low packages and other diet foods were labeled with saccharin. But there's another very important source of exposure, particularly for children, young children, and that is when they go to fast food outlets and they get Coke or Pepsi there, there's no requirement for labeling. And we have evidence that in the fast food outlets with supplying Coke, saccharin is added. Saccharin is the cheapest sweetener, and for this it's added together with mixed together with aspartame because there is a bitter taste for saccharin. So here we have continuation of children's exposure to this bladder carcinogen, and also a precedent. The floodgates industry is now attacking the whole of listings of carcinogens in a wide range of ways. They've done this with saccharin. They've tried to do this with tamoxifen. AstraZeneca has been urging government not to list tamoxifen as carcinogenic. As you know, tamoxifen is being used to prevent cancer in women. There's not the slightest evidence that it will prevent breast cancer in women. There's also clear-cut evidence that it produces a high incidence of complications, sometimes lethal short-term complications. And over and above that, the healthy women that are being dosed on this, and every woman over the age of 60 is regarded as at high risk. So essentially what AstraZeneca and the American Cancer Society want is to have a large-scale national program in which all women are put on tamoxifen to prevent breast cancer when there's no evidence this will do so. We have two European trials which show that it's of no value in preventing breast cancer. And furthermore, we have strong evidence that the actual risks, that uterine cancers, pulmonary embolism, and other fatal short-term risks far outweigh the alleged benefits. And in addition, women are not informed of an even more important risk. That is the fact that tamoxifen is one of the most potent liver carcinogens. Now, let me be clear. We're talking about the use of tamoxifen in healthy women because the National Cancer Institute, National American Cancer Society, with strong, enthusiastic backing of AstraZeneca, the manufacturer of tamoxifen, is persuading women to enter into trials with this and also with another drug called raloxifen or Evista, manufactured by Eli Lilly, which is told to be effective. But in fact, with Eli Lilly's own evidence shows that it is a very serious risk factor for ovarian cancer. At the lowest doses tested by Eli Lilly, it produced ovarian cancers in rats and mice. And this information hasn't been disclosed by Eli Lilly on its warnings and is being totally ignored by the National Cancer Institute and American Cancer Society.
You talk extensively about National Breast Cancer Awareness Month in your new book, The Politics of Cancer Revisited, talking about what many women would consider a very important month to focus on the issue of breast cancer. It's become the month of October. You say it's an industry-sponsored month.
I say it's a total scam. First of all, it's been funded by Zeneca since about 1985, and Zeneca was a spin-off of Imperial Chemical Industries, the world's largest manufacturer of industrial chemicals, carcinogenic industrial chemicals and pesticides. In National Breast Cancer Awareness Month, there's not a mention of prevention, and there's a wide range of known risk factors or causes of breast cancer. Not a word about that. The focus is on mammography, almost exclusively premenopausal mammography. There's no mention of the fact that premenopausal mammography is that America is the only country in the world that recommends premenopausal mammography. No other country practices it for two reasons. It's ineffective. There's a high incidence of falsely diagnosed breast cancers and a high incidence of missed breast cancers. And also it's dangerous because of the high levels of radiation, because of the compression of the breast, which can rupture small blood during two plates during the mammography. Which can rupture small blood vessels and spread an early undiagnosed breast cancer into one that's lethal because it metastasizes, and other series of other reasons. And as far even as postmenopausal mammography, recent prestigious study in the most prestigious journal, The Lancet, did an analysis on postmenopausal mammography and came to the conclusion there's no evidence for its effectiveness at all. And here we have an industry which the American Cancer Society is pushing to be routine for all women in this country, which will cost at least $5 billion a year just for premenopausal women, which is dangerous, which is ineffective. And we have breast self-examination, which is at least as effective. And women can be trained to examine their breasts within 15, 30 minutes. They can practice breast self-examination once a month. It's cheap, it's safe, and it's effective. No more than 90% of all breast cancers are recognized by women themselves.
Dr. Sam Epstein, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. He's the author of The Politics of Cancer Revisited, professor of occupational and environmental medicine at the School of Public Health, University of Illinois Medical Center at Chicago. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back with him in just a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. My guest is Dr. Samuel Epstein. He is author of The Politics of Cancer Revisited, his latest book. It's close to 800 pages. It's a republishing with a lot of new information of the original Bible, The Politics of Cancer. He is a professor of occupational and environmental medicine at the School of Public Health, University of Illinois Medical Center at Chicago, has written hundreds of articles on cancer, and is specifically an expert on the toxic and carcinogenic effects of environmental pollutants in air, water, and the workplace, and also looks at ingredients and contaminants in consumer products, foods, cosmetics, and household products. What should we be most concerned about, Dr. Epstein?
We should be concerned most of all about the fact that the nation is facing an unparalleled epidemic of cancer. One in every two men will get cancer in their lifetime. One in every three women will get cancer in their lifetime. You can't explain this away on the basis of genetics or increased longevity or just on smoking. Smoking is responsible for about a quarter or so of the increase in the incidence of cancer since 1950. For many cancers, non-smoking cancers, we've seen rates of increase of 200%, like non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, multiple myeloma, and prostate cancer, but for childhood, brain and nervous system cancers, 40% increase, and so on and so forth. Now, there's strong evidence relating this unparalleled escalation of cancer rates to avoidable exposures to industrial carcinogens in our total environment, our air, our water, our consumer products, and the workplace. By consumer products, I mean foods, cosmetics, and household products. And in the book, The Politics of Cancer Revisited, we go into this in some detail and provide information on the hazards for mainstream foods, for mainstream cosmetics and toiletries, and mainstream household products. In other words, by mainstream, I mean ones produced by the large industries, and point out that virtually there is no labeling whatsoever in food, for instance. No, of all the thousands of different toxic and carcinogenic ingredients in vegetables and produce, there is no warning on the cancer risks of any particular food. For hot dogs, for instance, which are heavily contaminated with nitrosamines, due to the presence of nitrites which interact with amines there, we have evidence showing that regular consumption of hot dogs is associated with a fourfold increase in brain cancer in children and a sevenfold increase in leukemia. Milk in this country, which comes from cows injected with a genetically engineered hormone, poses grave risks of breast, colon, and prostate cancer. Cosmetics and toiletries have a list of ingredients on the back, but without any expert knowledge of chemistry and toxicology and carcinogenesis, these names mean absolutely nothing. There's no indication as to which of these are carcinogenic. And furthermore, there's a lot of ingredients themselves which are harmless, but which contain, which can act either as precursors of carcinogens or break down or are contaminated. With household products, there's no labeling whatsoever. But there's a vast body of information tucked away in the scientific literature or buried in government and industry files on the carcinogenic avoidable risks of exposures to these products. Now, we're not dealing with the chicken little skies falling in situation, because for every unsafe product on the market, for every unsafe consumer product, there are safe alternatives. Safe alternatives by the growing organic industry, organic food industry, by the growing alternative safe product industry, by the growing alternative safe household product industry. These are small industries, but what consumers can do is they can punish the reckless industries by boycotting them and shop for safe products. In other words, let the marketplace and consumer knowledge and information take over from where the cancer establishment, the National Cancer Institute, and the American Cancer Society has failed to inform Congress, the regulatory agencies, and the public of these avoidable risks. And for these reasons, I charge the cancer establishment, the National Cancer Institute, and American Cancer Society with major responsibility for losing a winnable war against cancer.
You did an expose that you got a Project Censored Award this year for on the American Cancer Society, one of the largest nonprofits in this country today, one of the wealthiest, asking questions like, where have all the billions gone? But can you talk about your concerns about the Board of Trustees, the American Cancer Society?
Well, the foundation, the board of the trustees and the foundation, or the directors of the foundation, are a who's who of industry interest, particularly the cancer drug industry, Amgen, Biogen, what have you, also a wide range of other industries, and these are industries that contribute over $100,000 a year. So with the banking investment and the biotechnology and entertainment industries, they really have a pretty strong grip on the American Cancer Society, and the fact that they were chosen really reflects the American Cancer Society's close and interlocking interests with a wide range of industries, ranging from the cancer drug industry to the cosmetic industry to the mammography industry. And in fact, I should quote from the Chronicle of Philanthropy, which is the nation's leading watchdog for charities, and I quote verbatim, "The American Cancer Society is more interested in accumulating wealth than saving lives." And in the book, The Politics of Cancer Revisited, I provide a laundry list of acts of hostility or indifference of the American Cancer Society to prevention, of its budget of $700 million a year. Less than 0.5% goes on prevention, and it's the annual facts and figures. There's virtually no mention at all of prevention of any cancers. But let me just give you a couple of examples of their recklessness. As you know, there is a law called the Delaney Law, which was passed at the initiative of Congressman Delaney in 1958, which basically says thou shalt not add any carcinogen to foodstuff, and whether it's been shown to be carcinogenic in animal systems or in human studies. And historically, for the last 25 years or so, the American Cancer Society has fought vigorously against this. And just very recently, the American Cancer Society joined forces with the Chlorine Institute. Listen to this, to the Chlorine Institute, which represents the interest of the pesticides worldwide, and particularly the chlorinated organic pesticides, in an effort to trivialize growing national concerns of contamination of foods with carcinogenic pesticides. And the list goes on. And for this reason, I strongly urge the public to boycott the American Cancer Society, I charge them with overwhelming indifference, reckless indifference, with bloated budgets, with high salaries, with high expense accounts, and with misleading the public into the fact they're winning the war against cancer, whereas in fact they play a major role in losing a winnable war. And the money that is now being given to the American Cancer Society should instead be given to local community organizations which are fighting battles against cancer, or to large national organizations which have cancer prevention as one of their objectives. And I should mention that in the website of the Cancer Prevention Coalition, you'll find a great deal more information on the American Cancer Society. And our website is preventcancer.com, preventcancer.com, and of course, far more details in the book, The Politics of Cancer Revisited.
Dr. Sam Epstein is our guest. What about the emphasis on diagnosis and treatment and genetic research when it comes to cancer? You often hear, they're looking into the breast cancer gene.
Well, as a scientist who's worked in fundamental mechanisms of carcinogenesis, and as a physician who's been in, who's worked in major medical centers treating cancer in both in England and this country, I think it's absolutely critical that we spend time, energy, money, and research on diagnosis and on treatment and basic genetic research. Nobody argues that. What we're arguing about is the total imbalance. We're arguing about between that and prevention. The National Cancer Institute and American Cancer Society are fixated on damage control, treatment and diagnosis and genetic research, but with indifference or hostility to cancer prevention. What we're talking about is a parity. In other words, at least 50% of the budget of the National Cancer Institute and American Cancer Society should go towards research in the areas of primary prevention, to providing information to Congress, to regulatory agencies and the public, and this doesn't happen at the moment. And also, this research on genetics, of course, is of fundamental importance, but genetics can't explain in any way the massive escalation in cancer rates since 1950. The population, the genetics of human populations hasn't changed for thousands of years. So genetics has nothing to do with the escalating incidence of cancer. Furthermore, you can't explain it away on the basis of longevity, because all our data on increasing rates are standardized to reflect increasing age, and you can't explain it away on the basis of smoking, because smoking is responsible for about a quarter of the increase of the incidence of overall cancers, and most of the dramatic increases are in non-smoking related cancers like non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, multiple myeloma, childhood cancers, etc.
Dr. Sam Epstein, what about specifics about the products we use? For example, you write in your book, The Politics of Cancer Revisited, about lanolin. What is lanolin, and is it dangerous in itself?
Lanolin comes from sheep's wool, and most of us would assume that it's a perfectly harmless product. And in fact, it could be a harmless product, but for the fact that at least half the preparations of lanolin...
This goes into creams, skin creams?
And it has very wide uses in personal care products. Are contaminated with chlorinated organic pesticides, particularly DDT. And this is... So when you see the label lanolin, where you see lanolin mentioned, you think it's perfectly safe, but in fact, as I say, it's highly contaminated. Now, I should point out that cosmetics... we're dealing with four sets of areas in which the consumer can protect himself or herself. One is foods, two is cosmetics and toiletries, three is household products. As detailed in the book, the mainstream products there are heavily contaminated with undisclosed carcinogenic ingredients and contaminants. The public has given no information. Let me give you another example of a product which is a very serious one, talcum powder, for instance, manufactured and sold by Bristol Myers Squibb and Johnson & Johnson. We have strong evidence showing that routine application of talc to the genital area of women, particularly in the reproductive years, is associated with a 3 to 4-fold increased risk of ovarian cancer.
Ovarian cancer,
a highly lethal cancer. Is there any warning on the label? No. Has FDA taken any action? No. The Cancer Prevention Coalition filed a citizen petition on this, demanding the labeling of talc. The answer was a deafening silence. Johnson & Johnson, Bristol Myers Squibb, also didn't respond. And is there a safe alternative? You bet there is. Cornstarch, just as effective and no hazard. And we're not dealing with and I could go through the whole list of thousands of personal care products on the market. We're not dealing with a chicken little sky is falling in situation. In all of these areas, when it comes to foods, you've got a growing market for organic foods, which are free of carcinogenic pesticides. You've got skim milk, particularly skim milk coming from farms like Horizon or Swiss Valley Dairy Farm, that get milk from dairy farmers that don't use the genetically engineered hormone RBGH, and this milk, which is contaminated with very high levels of a growth factor known as IGF-1, is strongly associated with major increased risks of breast, colon, and prostate cancer. So when it comes to foods, you've got the safe alternatives. When it comes to household products, which contain no ingredient disclosure, and they are literally witches' brews of carcinogens, you've got seventh generation, which provides safe alternatives. And when it comes to the personal care products, you've got Aubrey Hampton, which is a U.S. manufacturer of safe products, and you've got Newways, which is a MLM, multi-level marketing international company, which produces products which are personal care products, which do not contain any carcinogenic ingredients or contaminants.
What about hormone-injected beef and hormone-injected milk? what exactly is that? Monsanto has been fighting companies around this country not to label products RGBH or BGH free, or bovine growth hormone free, because they say it suggests that it's dangerous.
Well, it didn't have to fight very hard, because the Food and Drug Administration has been working hand in hand with Monsanto since 1982. Information in FDA files clearly shows that, first of all, that RBGH produces a very serious veterinary hazards. In fact,
explain what it is.
RBGH is genetically engineered bovine growth hormone, which normally bovine growth hormones is responsible for lactation, for both in humans and in cows. And by injecting this genetically engineered hormone, you increase levels of milk production by about 10%. But you also induce a wide range of serious veterinary hazards in cattle, which are now fully, 20 of these are finally disclosed on the label. But in addition, drinking this milk is associated with major increased risks of breast, colon, and prostate cancers due to the very high levels of IGF-1. And FDA knows all about this, so they work hand in hand. And the most important thing about it is Monsanto is now saying, trust us when it comes to genetically engineered foods, the soy and others, without any published evidence on the safety or of environmental and public health safety. It says, trust us. But the last 20 years of track record of Monsanto on RBGH, genetically engineered bovine growth hormone, is a track record of manipulation and suppression of data, which is, to my mind, from a public health standpoint, is criminal. And this is facilitated by the silence of the National Cancer Institute, the active and support of Monsanto by American Cancer Society, and so on and so forth, and also the fact that Monsanto has infiltrated all levels of government and all branches of government.
Sam Epstein, what are your most important words of wisdom to leave our listeners with when it comes to the battle against cancer, both personally and politically?
Two things. There are innumerable ways in which you can reduce your risks of cancer, first of all, by shopping for safe products, consumer products of the kind we've talked about, food, cosmetics, and toiletries, and household products. Secondly, a very wide range of cancers, ranging from breast cancers, ovarian cancers, childhood cancers, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. We do know the causes of these, and there are simple ways of reducing exposure, the involuntary and avoidable exposures to these. So I urge listeners to inform themselves. You'll find detailed information in the book and the appendices on the risks of hormonal milk, of RBGH milk, the risks of sex hormones in meat, the consumer products, and the dangers of prescription drugs. I should point out that nearly one-third of prescription drugs which are being used, and I should mention that over a lifetime, the average person uses is about 700 prescription drugs. But in an industry-sponsored survey, in a secret industry-sponsored survey, it was shown that about 30% of the drugs looked at were carcinogenic. And in fact, let me just point out that if you want to compare prescription drugs and smoking, the annual incidence of lung cancer in heavy smokers is 1 in 250. The incidence of uterine cancer in women that are on unopposed on estrogen replacement therapy for 10 years is 1 in 100. So this is just one example of the overwhelming risks of prescription drugs. So when you go to your doctor, ask your doctor, is there any evidence that this drug is carcinogenic? And he'll say, well, why do you ask? Well, say, I want to know, and then he'll be irritated, but you force him to look up the physician's desk reference. And if there's evidence based on animal studies or on human studies that it's carcinogenic, refuse to take that drug and insist on a safe alternative. The National Cancer Institute, American Cancer Society has failed. Regulatory agencies have failed. The initiatives are in your hands to protect yourself and to take political action, both by boycotting the American Cancer Society, demanding congressional inquiries on the track record of the National Cancer Institute to explain its criminal neglect of prevention, which is a major factor in the massive increase in cancer rates over the last few decades.
Sam Epstein, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Dr. Sam Epstein is Professor of Occupational and Environmental Medicine at the School of Public Health, University of Illinois Medical Center at Chicago. His book is called The Politics of Cancer Revisited. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In a surprise raid yesterday, the Serbian government seized control of Belgrade City broadcaster Studio B, closing down its news program. The attack also pulled the plug on independent radio B292 in Belgrade. That's the opposition radio station. A statement released yesterday over the signatures of Deputy Serbian Prime Minister Vojislav Šešelj, the leader of the Serbian Radical Party, and Milovan Bojic, a prominent member of the Yugoslav left, said that the Republic of Serbia had taken control of Studio B because the station had repeatedly called for the overthrow of the Serbian government. The director and editor-in-chief of Studio B, who's a member of the Serbian Renewal Movement, that's an opposition movement, described the act as completely illegal. He added that it demonstrated that the government is virtually introducing a state of emergency in Yugoslavia. Right now in Belgrade, mass demonstrations are beginning throughout the city, and scores of people are being arrested. We're joined in the studio in New York by Natasha Kandic. She is director of the Humanitarian Law Center in Belgrade, usually there. She's here now, and we'd like to get your response to this latest news. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
What do you think? Is this a surprise to you that they've closed down these independent media outlets?
Personally, me and many people from Belgrade and in Serbia expected some more repressive measures of government because, you know, the end of all people see that Milosevic's power is close to end, but he will try to do everything to keep power. And closing the most important opposition media, Studio B, and B292 and Radio Index is the most serious attack on independent media in Serbia.
Why is this happening now?
I think that the regime of Milosevic is in big panic. They will try to do everything to stop democratic forces in Serbia, to stop changes, to stop to see Serbia close to European and European countries and to international community. He's accused for war crimes, and he's only president of state in the world accused for war crimes, and everything is in connection with war crimes committed in Kosovo and in the former Yugoslavia.
Do you think that Slobodan Milosevic should be tried at The Hague as a war criminal?
I don't believe. I cannot imagine that Milosevic will be in the front of tribunal. Something will happen before that. Probably, I think as many analysts in Serbia, that Milosevic will disappear in one moment.
Yesterday on Democracy Now! We spoke with Jovan Radovic, who is one of the founders of Otpor, the student opposition movement. That's certainly more than a student movement at this point. He was talking about the being very critical of Milosevic, but also being opposed to the NATO bombing. What is your stance?
You know, I always asking myself why international community didn't bomb and stop Milosevic in 92, because all people from the former Yugoslavia remember what's happened in Vukovar, Croatia city Vukovar. At that time, it was the time to stop Milosevic, but international community continued
what
to support.
What happened in Vukovar,
the whole city is destroyed. It is a city without without one house in Perth. Everything is destroyed.
Who lived there?
Serbs and Croats live together. And during 3 months, Serbian forces action towards Vukovar, every individual house was destroyed by Serbian and Yugoslav army forces.
Any people killed?
Yes, many people were killed, but all Croats were expelled by Serbian and Yugoslav army forces And at that time, everybody saw that Milosevic as a president, as politician, is danger not only for other people, other nation, that he's danger for the peace in the world.
What did the NATO bombing do to or for Slobodan Milosevic?
You know, I think that NATO bombardment stopped Milosevic, stopped killing Albanians in Kosovo, and it was the main result of NATO. But after the ended of war in Kosovo, international community didn't have really strategy what to do after after the war, how to improve situation, how to show Albanians that they are free, without, you know, laws, without infrastructure in Kosovo. Ordinary people expected from international community big changes. Spent 1 year without electricity, without freedom to move to Kosovo, because, you know, minorities were attacked by extremists, but Albanians were attacked by some criminals and by lack of order and normal life.
We're talking to Natasha Kandic. She is director of the Humanitarian Law Center in Belgrade, Yugoslavia. She's just in the United States right now as a major crackdown is taking place. Many people are calling it a state of emergency in Yugoslavia, with the independent media stations closed, radio and press as well, people taking to the streets. Scores of people have been arrested, protests everywhere. Natasha Kandic, you are known for being the leading Serbian advocate, documenting what happened to Albanians in Kosovo. What happened to Albanians? And also then, what happened to the Serbs and the Roma since?
You know, what happened to Albanians is the same, thing, what's happened to Muslims, to Croats, during the armed conflict in the former Yugoslavia. Milosevic always attacked people from the former Yugoslavia. You know, he has responsibility for thousands and thousands missing people in Bosnia. He has responsibility for thousands and thousands killed people, Albanian in Kosovo, and a few thousand missing Albanians. And I was in Kosovo because my human rights area is called the former Yugoslavia. Albanians, after Rambouillet conference, Albanians were left to be alone. All international organization left Kosovo expecting NATO bombardment. In those situation, I could only to bring decision to go there and to be not only with my staff, but with friends, with people, without any protection. And I was there and to see killing, to see humiliation, to see expulsion. And every time after my return to Belgrade, I was witness to see that people in Belgrade, Serbs, are without information what's happened in Kosovo. And, you know, the war in Kosovo and the killing of Albanians is stopped. But Kosovo is part of Balkan region. Serbia is part of Balkan region. Nobody succeeded to stop Milosevic until now.
Did the bombing escalate the killing of Albanians?
No. I think that Milosevic took NATO bombardment as explanation to organize expulsion of Albanians. It was, you know, planned. It was punishment. It was a strategy how to try to keep Kosovo. You know, a few hundred thousand of Albanians were expelled during the NATO bombardment. After the first day of NATO bombardment, Serbian forces began to expel Albanians with killing, with robbery, with destructing the property, killing especially the young people, young boys.
Do you think this would have happened to the extent that it did if the NATO bombing had not taken place?
You know, I never seen before, for the short time, thousands and thousands killed people. But, you know, it was Milosevic took only a NATO bombardment to try to keep Kosovo. And it was very useful for him to try to expel Albanians. And he thought that NATO will stop to bomb and expelled Albanians will stay abroad without possibility to return their houses. It was clear because, you know, probably 300,000 Albanians left without their identity cards. Serbian forces, policemen used to take them on the border, their passports, identity cards. It was clear that somebody from officials ordered them to destroy evidence that Albanians are the citizens of Yugoslavia and Kosovo.
What about what's happened to the Serbs and the Roma people since? And for an American audience, I think most people never even hear the term Roma, if you could explain who these people are.
No, Albanians are majority in Kosovo. Probably 10% of population are Serbs, Roma, Muslims, and Turks. And in practice, in the field, Romas are very close to Serbs. Muslims also close to Serbs because they speak the same language. You know, it was. I was very surprised after the end of war when I saw that Kosovo Liberation Army began to expel minorities, especially Serbs and Romas. And they saw The Roma is Gypsy. And, you know, Roma succeeded to... they had very good social and cultural life in Kosovo, much better than in Serbia or in Montenegro or in the former Yugoslavia. They had schools in their own language. They had houses, they had small businesses, and I think that Kosovo will have future as democratic state if they establish conditions to return, especially Romas, and accept Roma as a part of Kosovo community. And at the moment, in this situation, probably it's too early to think about returning of Serbs, but Roma is not only a minority in Serbia, in the former Yugoslavia. Roma are a European minority without, you know, adequate protection.
What is happening to the Serbs in Kosovo right now?
I said that in situation, in presence of international administration, international forces, some part of Kosovo Liberation Army began to conduct expulsion. Expel Serbs, killing them, threatening them that they should leave Kosovo because their country is Serbia, not to Kosovo. And, you know, 100,000 Serbs left Kosovo in accordance with peace agreement, I think on police and members of Yugoslav army and paramilitaries and armed Serbs. But 100,000 Serbs decided to stay in Kosovo, to live in Kosovo in different conditions, to see Albanians as government in Kosovo under the international protection. And I'm so sad but Kosovo Liberation Army decided to change Kosovo, to change and establish Kosovo without minorities. And international community was not prepared to see and to deal with this situation. They came to Kosovo to protect Albanians from Serbian forces and Yugoslav army and Serbian paramilitaries. They didn't expect violation against civilians and minorities. And they spent 1 year in Kosovo watching what's happened in the field. And after 1 year, I think that the international community has enough knowledge to improve situation in Kosovo, to show Albanians that they can achieve independence only showing a respect of minorities' rights.
Mm-hmm. Natasha Kandic, can you talk about the Albanian poet Brovina, now imprisoned in Serbia?
Flora Brovina is very simply but very important Albanian woman. She's the doctor, but she's human rights and humanitarian activist. She's only person in Kosovo who decided to stay during the NATO bombardment and to continue to work with refugees, with children and displaced persons from Kosovo. She spent in April very dangerous time in Kosovo working in her office and her center for refugees and children. And Serbian police arrested her to show that they have power to do. Flora Brovina is only Albanian prisoner in Serbia who is willing to talk as a person who is worried for whole world. She is important not only for Albanian communities, from Serbian community. She's important as person, as with her thinking for whole world.
I want to thank you very much for being with us, Natasha Kandic, director of the Humanitarian Law Center in Belgrade. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Jeremy Scahill and David Love. Errol Maitland's our technical director. Matthew Finch is our engineer. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!